From the Atlantic to the Pacific, from mountain crest to mountain crest, from the canyons to the clouds and into the cosmos, we are pumping wattage high and low, plus streaming worldwide on the internet and keeping you company tonight. It's a place to relax and hang out. I'm your host, Vance Pollock, in the captain's seat for Joshua P. Warren, and this is Speaking of Strange, giving you the latest and discussing the weirdest. We have assembled the finest team of reporters and most intriguing guests. We are the favorite program of hodags, wendigos, skunk apes, and donkey devils. So, stay tuned. This hour, John Hare is the author of books including Coal Mine Disasters of North Carolina, Encounters with Great White Sharks, Gold Mines of North Carolina, and Great Hurricanes of North Carolina. He has written extensively on lighthouses in Florida, North Carolina, and South Carolina, the geography of North Carolina, as well as regional Revolutionary and Civil War history, all subjects that I love. But then there's a sideline that I think listeners of Speaking of Strange will be particularly interested in, including ghost towns on the Upper Cape Fear, bizarre tales of the Cape Fear country, monsters of North Carolina, mysterious creatures in the Tar Heel State, and most recently, flesh falls and blood rains. John, as we've read some of these titles, there's a lot of respectable sort of regional history there, and then there's the odd titles. What got you interested in the sort of unusual subject matter, if you will?
Well, I guess one of the things that really drew me to it was there's a lot of crossover in a lot of the folklore type stories back in the old days when people would have encounters with animals and stuff. And I guess it entered our local folklore here in the Carolinas, and people had, you know, different stories about it. And as time went on, they might have forgotten some of those stories, and so they would, sort of assign some different names and stuff. So as time went on, you know, it's almost like people began to forget a lot of their own regional stories and folklore and stuff. So originally, one of the things I wanted to do was to pull together a collection some of those odd, I guess for lack of a better term, some of those odd tales, and bring them to light, let folks look at it and say, hey, you know, look at this. We've got some pretty strange stuff happening right here in our own backyard.
Absolutely. Monsters of North Carolina, mysterious creatures in the Tar Heel State. You cover a lot of ground in that one, from the mountains and down to the coast. And what got me, what made it show up on my radar was searching for information on this creature known as the Santer. Basically, I think a lot of the early accounts, at least, sounded a lot like a Black Panther. Where did you run across the Santer tales, and what do you make of it?
Well, it's sort of a long question there to answer, and I have to give you a long answer rather to get to that. But the best thing that we do know is the name Santer was just sort of the name that grew up here, and a colloquial name here in the North Carolinians used when they were referring to like a mysterious beast that they would sometime encounter. Now, it wasn't necessarily always the same beast as the Santer, so a little community, say, over out in, you know, out in Caldwell area, and maybe out around Statesville, something like that, they might have an encounter with a Santer. And folks out around Alamance County or something, they might have an encounter with an entirely different creature, but, they would still call it a Santer because they didn't really know what it was. So it's just sort of a catch-all phrase that had developed. Now, we can trace pretty good reliability where it came from, the name, and which it started back around 1890 with a newspaper editor named J.P. Caldwell over with the Statesville Landmark. He started documenting some of these things, and, you know, sort of as stories went along, they sort of grew, and the community sort of caught on, and different people would, you know, see different things, and tell him about these things and stuff. But yeah, that's like I say, it's one of those things that kind of, it's a name that people use for a mysterious beast, but it's not necessarily the same beast.
Well, in Iredell County, down there around Statesville and those parts, you mentioned those newspaper articles coming out in 1890. It seems like as more and more of these articles were published, and then some of them picked up and carried in other newspapers around the state, throughout the state, and around the country, for that matter. In some cases, I think they made the newswire with some of these claims. Some of those later articles start to be rather tongue-in-cheek, like the publisher and maybe the editorial writers are taking a little creative license, maybe even having a bit of fun. Did you get the feeling when you were reading some of those early accounts that a lot of these people may have just been trying to pull the reader's leg a little bit?
I think they may have, some of them may have been incredulous about what they were hearing. And so, you know, of course, when somebody came in and said, you know, I saw something that looked like a hyena attack the chicken coop out here, then of course that would grow and they'd have to add their 2 cents worth to it. And so these things would grow. And so eventually it sort of get, you know, take on a whole new, you know, whole new characteristic and stuff. And so, you know, that would, was definitely, I think a lot of that was tongue in cheek. And if not the original reports, then, you know, at least some of the reporting on it definitely was. A lot of times they would, you know, I guess you would say if it's a slow news day, you know, people are always looking for a good story like that. You know, folks, you know, 100 years or so ago, you know, they were just as interested in animal tales, I guess, as we are today.
I would agree with that. As far as these Carolina big cat stories go, you talk to the people at the Nature Center here in Asheville or any of these people who should know, the scientific community, and they'll tell you that the largest native cat is the bobcat that might be 40 pounds on the outside, and I think Western Carolina is even their mascot is the catamount. But do you place any credulity in the idea that there may have been other larger cats, legitimate sightings of such animals here in the state?
Well, that's a question that is frequently, I guess, debated among people who look at the history of the wildlife of the area, the native flora and fauna and all that. Really, if you go back, if you go back into the 1700s, and John Lawson, of course, you probably remember hearing about him. You know, as an explorer, came through early Carolina back then, and he was made his journey of 1,000 miles. He traveled into the interior of the province, you know, left Charlestown and went around into the deep into the area, settled, you know, crossed over some of the different settlements and stuff along the Catawba River and all that, and then he eventually ended up, you know, down there in Bathtown and stuff. On his journey, he actually mentioned, you know, sort of I guess he would have been one you would say had one of the first mentions of a strange cat encounter. And was an unusual cat, and he called it a tiger. Now, of course, you know, we sit there and say, okay, well, what was he looking at? Because, you know, he didn't, you know, there weren't, of course, there are no tigers native, you know, to North America like that. And so later on, the name tiger was actually applied to, like, bobcats and stuff. Some people would call them tigers as a colloquialism, but back in Lawson's day, he actually, you know, knew the difference between, like, a cougar and a catamount or something, and a bobcat. So this tiger was something entirely different. And he said, you know, it was bigger than these other things. And, you know, he had an encounter with it, you know, and he actually, you know, got a shot off of one. So it's like, you know, people theorize, well, what was that? So, you know, it could have been a lot of things. You know, you just don't know. Some people even suggested that it could have been a jaguar, you know, a remnant of the jaguar population that, you know, we know some fossil evidence, you know, existed here a while back. So who knows if, Maybe it held out. So
even some of these early species that are thought to be extinct, there's the idea that at least as late as the 1700s, there may have been a few examples of those animals here in our state.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you know, it would just, you know, we can only imagine what some of these first people who were, you know, pushing back the frontier, what some of the wildlife they first encountered. We can only, you know, only imagine it. You know, just some of the things they must have seen that would boggle our mind today.
That's right. In writing Monsters of North Carolina, were there any particular creatures that you found particularly engaging to your imagination? Any that you would ponder? Boy, I'd like to have a photograph of that one.
Oh yeah, yeah. The of course, there are plenty of you know, lots of different animals mentioned in that book. It was it was sort of a covered the whole spectrum, you know, the different animals and mysterious creatures that we have here. So there's a whole lot of things that wish I could have had more opportunity to have studied it at different points and to include it in that book, and some of the different different sea creatures and stuff that have been called out here. Probably one of the one of my favorite, I guess, of these mysterious mammals would have been, you know, the one I guess that is the most famous for now would have been the vampire beast of Bladenboro.
That one, that one gets a lot of play. Joshua P. Warren sent me an email the other week and said, when you start talking about strange beasts in Carolina, that's the one that comes to mind. He said they even have a festival down in Bladenboro that's loosely based on this legend.
That's right. Yeah. They, I guess they finally, you know, decided, you know, to embrace the creature. Not, for a long time they tried to play it down and try. It's kind of, some of them were embarrassed, I guess, you know, by all the attention it brought to them. But now I guess they some of the festival organizers or whatever must, you know, understand that brings in a lot of people. But yeah, there was, the woods were full of people down there, and it was, hunting that thing back in, the December of 54. And so, they, all kind of different, people claim they killed different things and different cats, and somebody would bring out a bobcat, let's say, and then next thing you know, there was another attack, another sighting. So it was like, well, apparently that wasn't what was doing it. So there's all kind of stuff in the woods down there.
Definitely.
Leighton County's a remote place.
Well, John, we're going to take a short break. Will you stick around with us? I want to talk to you a little bit about your most recent book, Flesh Falls and Blood Rains. Have you got time for that?
Yeah, sure. I got time.
All right. We're going to a short break, folks. Stick around. Talking with John Hare, author of some great books, regional histories of, odd things, in addition to the respectable stuff. We'll be right back. Speaking of strange.
Well, going pretty fast, I look behind, here comes the devil doing 99. I say, I'm on fire, 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 I'm on the line.
Let's drag now!
We're back on Speaking of Strange, joined this hour by John Hare, just like the hair on your head, only two R's at the end. John Hare, he's the author of a great many books dealing with North Carolina history, some of it a little more unusual, just the way you like it. We spoke a little bit about Monsters of North Carolina, Mysterious Creatures in the Tar Heel State, and just a few months back, John, we saw the release of a book called Flesh Falls and Blood Rains. And that kind of clicked with me because I had read of instances of red rain or black rain, very strange sort of anomalous things. A Fortiana, as some people might refer to it. Tell us a little bit about your book, Flesh Falls and Blood Rains, if you would.
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's a that was a project a long time in the making. I had been promising people for several years that I would sit down and you know, compile a book about that stuff, because you know, I'd collected, you know, little accounts and run across accounts of those occurrences. Of course, today, you know, if we saw a red material fall out of the sky, it would still, you know, still make the news, obviously. But you know, somehow you could always come up with a reason for it being up there. You know, you'd say, well, you know, if push comes to shove, you say, well, I guess an airplane flew through a flock of birds or something, or you know, somebody got caught in a, you know, in an airplane as it was flying over. So, but what intrigues me are the stories of the flesh and blood falling from the sky in the days before powered flight. Because now you take out the you take out that human element. It's like, well, now how do you get the blood and the red matter into the sky now? And so that was I guess the motivation I had. One of the early stories that used to be related down around the house. Of course, my dad was from Sampson County down there, and he would tell me about an incident that had taken place not too far from where he grew up. Of course, he grew up down in the Mingo section, and so this would have happened just south of there, not far from you know, between there and outside of Clinton down there, about 13 miles, I believe, southeast of Clinton.
Right.
And if you have a map of North Carolina, you can look that up. But, yeah, that was a farm of a gentleman named Thomas Clarkson, and he was out there, and his children came running up, and they said, you know, there's meat falling from the sky. And of course, when they looked, there are these little, you know, pieces of flesh, actually, that are scattered around the little area there where they're standing in their field out there. And of course, they looked up, there were no buzzards, you know, in the sky or anything like that. And so, basically, they, you know, were flabbergasted. They called over one of their neighbors, and you know, he's an educated physician over there. I think his name was Dr. Campbell, and so he had scooped up a little bit of it, and he took it out and used it as a sample, and so he took it and he studied it. We don't really know a lot more, much more about what became of that sample, you know, other than you know, they took it and took it to Fayetteville, and put it under a microscope and looked at it, and you know, said it was indeed flesh, liver, and brains, I believe, was in it. So yeah, you know what caused that? You know, who would know?
Very very fascinating stuff. Now people think of weird rain, and the classic stories are frogs and fish and things like that. But when you talk about flesh and blood falling from the sky, that's almost a supernatural element. Now, I suppose you may have run across instances where people attributed a supernatural explanation to it.
Oh yeah, yeah. There have been accounts of you know, flesh and blood colored materials falling from the sky, you know, right on back into antiquity, and back in the old days, of course, you know, people would see that happen. They would you know, think it was a supernatural, you know, portents of doom a lot of times, and really, that connotation that it was some sort of a portent of evil approaching stayed right on up into the 1800s, when you know, a lot of times when people would see these things, they would say, uh-oh, something bad's going to happen, you know, and stuff. But yeah, they you know, chronicled these things back in the you know, even back in the Roman days, you know, a lot of you see a lot of accounts in a lot of writers would put those in there right before some big battle or something was going to happen. And so, of course, you have to, what's really difficult about a lot of those accounts is you have to try to separate what might be an actual account of something happening from some sort of, I guess, embellishment. And so, of course, you know, and like, say, for instance, if you're mentioning in Livy or one of those ancient writers, you know, they might tell you about a blood falling on the precinct of Jupiter or something there in Rome right before something happened. But a few lines later, they tell you that a child was born who, you know, stood up and said hail and then died, you know, stuff like that. So, you know, and so you have to kind of take some of that and put it with a grain of salt, I guess, proverbial grain of salt.
Right. Flesh Falls and Blood Rains by John Hare. That's two R's, spelled just like the hair on your head, but two R's. John Hare. And I encourage you folks to look up John Hare's list of books, man. I was surprised. How many published works are you responsible for at this point, John?
That's a good question.
I'm lost count?
I'm not quite sure. And to tell you the truth, I hadn't really sat down and haven't really sat down and counted them up yet. But I know the recent book, the most recent one there with The Flesh Falls and Blood Rain, that was published by Coach Whip Publications. And, of course, they've carried three of my titles with Coach Whip up there. A fellow by the name of Chad Armit. He's done a lot of publishing of different kind of natural history books and natural mysteries, Fortean phenomena, that kind of stuff. So he's a really good source, and he's also a good source if you ever run across his book about varmints and stuff like that, sainters and wampuses and so forth. He's one of the ringleaders in tracking down those kind of reports.
Okay, well you can bet I'll look him up. Now, Flesh Falls and Blood Rains, that's not just isolated to North Carolina. That one you had to get outside the bounds of the state a little bit. You call those accounts in from all over the place, right?
Oh, that's correct. Yeah. This is, this actually goes right on back, to the ancient world, you know, the Romans and the Greeks. Right on up into today, but most of the accounts are from back in the past, but they come from all over the world. You know, there are accounts in there from the most recent account was I actually interviewed some folks who collected some of the red rain that fell in India just a few years back, and so I interviewed those folks who were involved in that. I also interviewed some folks who gathered some samples of a red rain material that fell in Spain just a few years back. And so it's up to date. The book, what I try to do is make sure that we look at it through a scientific perspective, and also is to be a good historian to make sure, you know, that it's quotes. I use the sources, and it's thoroughly documented. So if somebody sits back and says, you know, where the heck did this hair guy come up with that? It's like, well, there you go, right? There's go look it up and read it for yourself.
No doubt that some of the accounts, there obviously was something strange falling from the sky. As you mentioned, some of it tested did turn out to be flesh and brain matter. Very, very peculiar, but the cause...
That's right.
The cause is the great mystery. No doubt that it did happen and has happened numerous times throughout history. Do you have anything particularly that you're curious about or that you think bears a book being written that might be in your future?
Well, the probably, I guess, right now we're looking at re-releasing the biography I did of Colonel David Fanny, who was a North Carolina loyalist, exiled after the war, died up in Canada. And so I'm working on re-releasing that one. That one was released about 15 or so years back. And so it's currently out of print. So that's going to be the next book publishing project that I work on.
Well, you're a busy man, John, and we thank you for taking time to spend with us here on Speaking of Strange. I encourage folks to look up John's repertoire, John Hare, H-A-I-R-R, and the gentleman is responsible for enough to keep you reading for quite some time. Especially, I appreciate the local, the regional angle, John, and we'll get you back on again. You'll act as a consultant on all these sort of things.
Well, there you go. I appreciate it. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to. I'll be on your show.
Bye-bye now. Speaking of strange, we'll be right back. Welcome back to Joshua P. Warren's Speaking of Strange. I'm Vance Pollock, hosting this virtual potpourri of all things paranormal. You like that, Sam?
Virtual potpourri.
I like it.
A virtual potpourri of all things paranormal. Right, that's another t-shirt.
Yeah. Writing it down.
We don't talk enough about potpourri, but a mixed bag isn't as catchy. But we're having that. Thanks, John Hare, for getting on here and talking about some of your books. I'll be reading them. That's a guy I just ran across a few days ago, and it just worked out. You know, it's very more synchronicity. Me and Shelley, we just carry it around with us, don't we, Shelley? And you know that little bit about we don't just talk about it; we go into the field to investigate.
Oh yeah.
We're going to demonstrate that for people. We are some of those people. Investigator Shelley Wright, myself, we do field work. We do our homework. We get out there and stalk the wild beasts in the night. And well, particularly I'm a graveyard ghoul, and I hope Shelley will be too after I drag her around to a few of them. We went to visit John Lyerly's grave.
Yes, we did.
Because it was the anniversary of his death. You folks may know that John Lyerly is a guardian spirit of ours after we bumped into his phantom in the old jail building on Marjorie Street some years ago. That was 2011, 6 years ago.
That's
does it feel
crazy.
Like?
Crazy. It
six
does
years
not.
Has just flown by. But we went out to visit John Lyerly's grave, walking back to the car. And you did mention when I was showing you the Santer and quizzing you about the, or Sainter, I noticed John pronounced it Sainter. When I showed you the photo, you said, what, is this a ink blot test? But I was actually thinking of,
turn it upside down and it could very well be.
is what we're doing, piecing all these disparate threads together, is that just like cloud gazing or staring at an ink blot? Sometimes you may question, or I question my own sanity, but I find all these little pieces of the jigsaw puzzle and don't really have to force them to fit. It's an easy fit. You know what I'm talking about?
Oh,
we
yeah.
were walking back to the car and we saw that gravestone right there by my car, and I looked down at it, and it caught my eye for some reason. Well, we were talking about Billy Brown. That's the next grave I want you to take you to visit, because okay. Billy Brown helped me out when I was doing some research. I was really, it was one of those things where a local historian of some renown challenges you to identify or tell me more about this mysterious photograph. And there are enough clues in there that I said, I can get this one. But I'd bared down it and used all the conventional techniques I could think of to crack the case. And I said, I don't know whose funeral this is. I don't know where it is. I ruled out a lot of guesses, but I found a photograph of a photo that was hanging on the wall in this parlor funeral. And in that photograph, luckily, Pack Library had a list of all the men in this photograph. It was streetcar motorman. That's the trolley. The old streetcar ran in Asheville for, 40 years. And the old guy sitting down on the front row to the furthest to the right was Billy Brown. For whatever reason, I decided that old guy in the photo knows whose funeral this is. If I could just get in touch with that old guy, and I know who he is. So I tracked down Uncle Billy's grave, and I went to visit Uncle Billy's grave, and I asked him, whose funeral is that in the photograph? And it wasn't as if he just answered back, but I woke up the next day with a couple long shot hunches that hadn't occurred to me before, lines of research to follow that eventually did lead me to the answer of whose grave that was. And then within the next couple weeks, I'm on Facebook, I'm in some of these history groups, and two different people post photographs of Uncle Billy Brown. What are the chances that that one man that's been dead for 75 or 100 years would go visit his grave and then go on the internet and people are posting pictures of him? And I had said nothing to anyone at that point. So on the way back to the car, I see this young lady's grave. She was a young woman, 27 years old. Her name was Rivers Brown Plemons. And that middle name Brown set me back. And then the name, first name Rivers, and she died in like 1930, along in the 1930s. And I thought, that's kind of a unique name, Rivers.
Rivers.
I'm going to look her up. Well, her father's name, of course, was William Brown. And she was from Tallahatchie, Mississippi. And just in recent weeks, I have been researching Tallahatchie, Mississippi, and recounting the fact that one of the most haunted places I've ever been. I actually went back and was reading the post that I made on the old Lemur group forum, the old Speaking of Strange forum. It still exists, folks. It's out there in the nether regions of the internet. But the old Lemur and Speaking of Strange forum, I had to read this post about Money, Mississippi, and how I went with a friend of mine down there to find the Tallahatchie Bridge that's portrayed in that song about Billy Joe McAllister, the Ode to Billy Joe. Do you know the song, The Day That Billy Joe McAllister Jumped Off the Tallahatchie Bridge? But anyway,
the look on her face says she doesn't.
But well, anyway, I thought it did, but I'm not so sure.
What are the chances that she's from Tallahatchie County? Her first name is Rivers, and I've been researching. And I told Stevie Tombstone when last time he was in town, the most creepy place I've ever been is down there near Greenwood, Mississippi, because he's got a song about Greenwood, Mississippi. He went down there and put a gravestone on one of the alleged graves of Robert Johnson. Robert Johnson had no marked grave. Now he's got three different marked graves in three different cemeteries. But the first time anybody ever put a stone on a supposed Robert Johnson, the late great blues man, if you don't know Robert Johnson, get to know him. But Stevie had put that gravestone there, and the locals were not appreciative. And they kind of ran him out of town and, accused him of trying to do a publicity stunt for his group, which the label had partially said him. So, yeah, accusations of doing a publicity stunt by putting a grave marker at Robert Johnson's grave, partially true. But we were just talking, just weeks ago at Byrish House, and I told him the creepiest place I've ever stood in my life was on the Tallahatchie Bridge
at Money, Mississippi, looking over the Tallahatchie River. And so we go to the cemetery, and we're walking back to the car. We find the grave of a young woman that's just right there, and it just jumps up at me. Her name is Rivers Brown Plemons. Her father was Billy Brown, like Uncle Billy we were talking about.
Right.
The only other old man that I could think of that I've ever called Billy was old fellow that lives out in Fairview, Billy Plemons. There's all these little synchronicities.
There are.
And I think everybody has them, but maybe people just don't assemble them the same way. Everybody can sit down at a table with a 5,000-piece jigsaw puzzle scattered everywhere. Some people are going to suck at it, but I'm really good at jigsaw puzzles. I think all the pieces do fit. So as you people are going about your day, I want to pitch a little experiment to you. And you can contact us through the Speaking of Strange Facebook page or website if you like. I'm going to throw this out there to you. During the upcoming week, you are going to pay attention. It's called trigger noticing, because initially you have to make a conscious effort to notice little details. But you're going to look for the number 3. You're especially going to look for multiples or threes in sequence. 33, 333, you're going to be seeing threes this week. You're going to notice those threes, and then you're going to try and figure out what the paranormal context for that observation is.
Dale Earnhardt's ghost.
Yep, it could be. Could be Dale Earnhardt's ghost. But that's my proposition to listeners of Speaking of Strange for this week, trigger noticing. That's the name of the exercise, trigger noticing. And you are going to train yourself this week to look for the number 3. Look for the number 3. And once you train yourself to look for little weird things that may not mean a whole lot to you, every morning you can wake up and the first hunch, the first thing that comes to you out of a dream, you're going to look for it that day. Like I was talking about crow calls and seeing that hawk when I was driving out to Lyerly's grave the other day. Maybe I don't know what you'll do, but you'll notice that number 3, and then the trick is to find some context for it. That's the tricky part. Find some context for these sightings. And I want you to report to us. SpeakingOfStrange.com, Speaking of Strange on Facebook, Speaking of Strange right here on Saturday night. We'll be right back. Bidding farewell to the Fire Monkey and welcome, Fire Rooster. It's the Chinese New Year edition of Speaking of Strange 2017. Knocked out joint on Mars by Buck Trail. I promised I wouldn't do a whole lot of music trivia, but what else you gonna do? Oh, maybe I'll read you this story about some new Adidas.
Okay.
Every day I dream about sports. Their new shoes will dissolve in your sink. This is from the technology above implemented. In an attempt to close the loop on production, Adidas has invented a shoe made from biodegradable artificial spider silk, nanotechnology that will melt away when you're done with them. Adidas has invented a running shoe that will decompose in the sink. Once you've worn it out, the company recommends 2 years of use. You can immerse the shoes in water, add a digestion enzyme called proteinase and let it work for 36 hours. It will cause the protein-based yarn to break down, and you'll be able to drain the liquefied shoes down the sink, everything except the foam sole, which will still require disposal. It sounds surreal, but the technology is straightforward. The upper is made from a synthetic biopolymer fiber called BioSteel, manufactured by a German company whose goal was to create spider silk. Wired describes the manufacturing process, at least what we know of it. AM Silk creates the BioSteel textile by fermenting genetically modified bacteria. Where didn't we read about some genetically modified bacteria with that extra pair of whatever it was? Gizmodo reports that that bacteria is E. coli. That was also a player in that previous story. That process creates a powder substrate, which AM Silk then spins into BioSteel yarn. All of this happens in the lab. According to Adidas, uses a fraction of the electricity and fossil fuels that plastics take to produce. Adidas says the shoes are 15% lighter than comparable running shoes while remaining strong and durable. They are non-allergenic and vegan. And if you're wondering, they will not melt on your feet in the rain because the proteinase enzyme is required for biodegradation. Wow, dissolvable shoes.
But how much is
biodegradable shoes?
To dissolve it when you're ready.
Here's your other little piece of trivia. Not all day I dream about sports, but Adidas, what does that name come from?
Shelly,
I don't know
what Adidas comes from.
Adi Dassler. That was two guys that started the company.
Well,
part of their names, Adi and Dassler. Adidas.
That would make sense.
Yeah.
A lot of record labels that just sound like gibberish are just like the first couple syllables of some of the main players' names. So, Adidas. La-di-da. you seeing number three yet, folks? Just keep your eyes open. That's my challenge. Next hour is, of course, the Dark 30 hour. And, whew, boy. Your ears are going to be ringing because the bell's going to get a workout. We slid it over there. The speaking of Strange Bell, who is Shelly Wright.
Well, she's more than just that.
She's a Southern Belle, and she is our official speaking Strange Bell, and she's going to be ringing the Florida Bell.
Not the Memphis Florida Bell.
No.
Although the pilot of the Memphis Belle, Captain Robert Morgan, from Asheville, North Carolina. Yeah, they say that he once flew the Memphis Belle on its side between the city and county buildings over the Asheville Plaza.
Yes, I think I have heard that.
Yes, because after they had completed so many missions, I mean, what was impressive about the Memphis Belle is that it didn't get shot down because the mortality rate for B-17s, pretty high. So to have survived how many ever sorties, they finally took them off active duty and sent them around the country on, like, bond drives and, hoorah, patriotic events and things like that, which must have been a better duty than flying over Europe and being attacked by Messerschmitts.
Later on, Harry Connick Jr. would star in the movie Memphis Belle. Harry Connick Jr. from New Orleans. New Orleans, home of voodoo. Voodoo, home of black magic. Black magic, home of numbers, number three.
There, you got it, man. Staring at clouds or ink blots. But,
or whatever those things are called.
You know,
marmots.
In the final analysis, I think if it's entertaining and harmless enough, go for it. I don't consider myself a paranoid, but there's something weird going on.
Avoid the noid.
a couple pizza guys, and obviously not noid fans here. Avoid the noid. This is Speaking of Strange, and coming up next hour, it's the Dark 30. Hey, We got a few seconds during this bumper. Did you see It Might Get Loud, Jimmy Page rocking out to this? Link Ray, North Carolina boy.
Is he really?
Yeah.
Where from?
Down east. Anywhere, I don't know.
Where they have mustard barbecue sauce, I don't know.
Yeah, Link Ray from North Carolina with Rumble.